We're going to dive right into this. So today we're going to do the first part of the H201. I had hoped to get through Article 5, but now that the technological problems happen, not a chance. We'll get through Article 4, and then we'll make sure that when I edit the next week's lecture to get to finish it, that we'll have plenty of time to get through what we need to get through. So as I talked about before, you guys went over the B101. The B101 and the H201 will be both, when and if you ultimately take your AREs, will be the two key agreements you'll look at. There's going to be other ones that I actually have been talking to. I may pull up some provisions on some of the other agreements so you guys can have some other samples of what will be on the ARE. Because they do talk about other agreements, but these are the basis. And as I've said throughout the semester, these two agreements are the basis of probably 80% of all the contracts you're going to see throughout your practice here in the States. Different countries use different other form documents, but in the U.S. it's largely the AIA. If it doesn't say AIA on it, and I sent you guys a copy of what it looks like, if it doesn't look exactly like that, what you're going to find over and over and over are provisions that are pulled from this document and stuck into bespoke agreements that are created by whether it's the architecture firm, the construction firm, or whomever else. There's one other thing I was going to say. Oh, this document, as we went over a couple weeks ago, this is the A200 series. There's an A100 series, and that one of the 100 documents will always accompany this A201, because these are what's called the general conditions for constructions. The 100 series will talk about the business end of the deal, so price, schedule, people who are, you know, the architect, identifying the party names, where notice is given, so the transactional part of the deals. This is, as I've said a couple times throughout in the semester, this portion of this is the rules of monopoly for how to play the game, how to build the project. This is what the contractor will look at most. It's not to say that there are provisions in the 100 series that aren't relevant. There are actually some very, very important agreements, provisions in that. We talk about how change orders are handled and other stuff. But when we get into what's actually being built and what they're supposed to do, this is the document that everybody will look at. One last thing, and then we'll go into the provisions themselves. There's a document called the A104. What the A104 does is traditionally, or primarily, you're going to use the 101, 102, and 103, and then you may jump to the 133. But the A104 takes bits and pieces from the 101, 102, and 103, combines them all together, and takes bits and pieces of this one and combines them all together. So the 104 is like a one-stop shopping. It doesn't have two documents. It's all in one. So it's often used for smaller projects. You know, something you can use it for a project up to, you know, $10 million. I wouldn't recommend it. I'd rather you guys use this document, but you'll see it for projects that are under $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, stuff like that for the A104. It's a smaller, kind of more condensed version. And without further ado, we're going to go through. So, like the B101, it is laid out in various articles. So we have the general provisions in 101. It was the initial information, and then we'll talk about what the responsibilities of the owner, what's the responsibility of the architect, what's the responsibility of the contractor. Each one of the sections will describe that. So from Article 1 through, we've been able to get through Article 5, but with the delay, it's going to be owner, contractor, architect, subcontractors in that order. But we'll probably just get through contractor today. In the first provision, and then what I've done, like I said, in the previous ones, when we looked at the language in the agreement, I highlighted things that are important that you guys can focus on, trying to break down what the intent and the meaning of this paragraph is. There's going to be other stuff that's in there. It's not like it's not important, but these are some things just that I just wanted to kind of highlight for you. So the first one on the contract documents, actually the first whole part of that identifies what's contract documents. And if you look at the agreement, contract documents is going to be a capitalized term. It's defining, this paragraph defines what contract documents are, CD. And the contract documents include your drawings, your specifications, this agreement, modifications, so change orders and everything else. And so what ends up happening is when you get on the project or if something goes wrong in the project, the contractor doesn't just say, I'm only supposed to abide by my A101 and my A201, because the A201 says, there are more documents outside there that you're going to need that are important. And then as we get through this, you're going to find out that there's some documents that are specifically, they're identified in this agreement, but they are not contract documents. That means they are not legally binding. An example is shop drawings. When we get to shop drawings, I'll explain that a little bit more. So, and that's what's highlighted in here. It doesn't include these contract documents, as a defined term, does not include the advertisement of the invitation to bid. So when you're going out to bid, you're going to send out information to all the potential contractors bidding on the project. There'll be lots of information in there. Nothing in that invitation to bid is considered a contract document. Now you're like, well, how do they bid on the project if they don't have drawings and specifications? They do, and those are in the invitation to bid. But there may be changes that happen between the invitation to bid and when the project is finally built or completed. And so what only counts from that is the final drawings and specifications, capital D, capital S. Same thing, the instruction to bid, sample forms, other things that are related to the bidding of the project. None of that are considered contract documents. The architect's agreement is a contract document for the architect, but not for the contractor, because the architect and the owner in that agreement, and so the contractor knows it exists and understands what it is for, but they're not bound by it because they are not parties to that architecture agreement. The same thing on the contractor side, the architect is not a party to that, so they're not bound to the terms and conditions unless there's specific references. So then here, we go through in 1.1.2, and it says the contract documents form it, and that's where we walk through, and they say they shall not be construed to create a contractual relation. This is the definition of saying who's in this agreement and who's not. So it doesn't. This document, this contract, doesn't create an agreement between contractor and architect. It doesn't create an agreement between the owner and the subcontractors, and it doesn't between the owner and the architect or the architect's consultants. It doesn't create those agreements. So that's one of the things that this document does. Other entities that are outside. But the architect at the end shall, however, be entitled to performance and enforcement of obligations under this contract intended to facilitate the performance of the architect's duties. So what does that part mean? Well, when we get to Article 4, there's a whole section on what the architect's supposed to do. And that's a headline or a reference to the contractor and saying, on this project, the architect's going to do A, B, and C. And so when it says the architect is entitled to performance and enforcement of the obligations in this agreement, it means that the contractor has to follow within Article 4 of this one, because many provisions in Article 4 mirror what's in the B101. There's also going to be provisions in here in the A201 that will be the reverse of in the B101. So remember we talked about in the B101, it said the architect is not responsible for means, methods, techniques, procedure, safety. Not. In this agreement, you're going to see a provision that says the contractor is responsible for means, methods, techniques, procedures, and safety. They're the mirror images, or the opposite images from what you're going to see in the B101. And it says in the E101, says the architect's not responsible for things like shop drawings and doing the math of what's going on, and they're not responsible for that. Whereas here in the A201, you're going to see where it says the contractor's not responsible for the design. So it's a very clear distinction between the two, and that's what 1.1.2 is saying. So we move on. Here's some defined terms. And sometimes I think about flipping this class and talking about the A201 before I talk about the B101. I don't do that for two reasons. One, it's an architecture class, so you know, like leaving you guys for the second semester doesn't seem fair. Second, it's a smaller document. This is much longer, and so there's a lot more information to take in, and you kind of got to get used to like what you need to think about. So it's there's more on this document, so you kind of warmed up for it. The reason why you might want to think about putting this document first is because it defines all the terms. If you remember, in the B101, there was this thing called the instruments of service. And we didn't see that term until we got to Article 7 when we were talking about copyrights. And there's no definition of it. It's a capitalized term, and you see it in the contract, the AIA contract, the B101, and you're like, okay, here's a capitalized term. I don't find a definition anywhere in it. It's in here. And there's a reference in small subnotes in the B101 that says definitions are found in the A201. So there's a reason to potentially teach it backwards, but really, we can get to the point, and I try to define when we go through the B101, I explain to you what they are. But here, so just so you know, the work, which you see throughout the B101, you'll see throughout this, that includes labor, materials, equipment, services to be provided by the contractor to fulfill the contractor's obligation. Architects perform services. Contractors perform work. So when you see the word work in the B101, it's referring to this. It doesn't include anything that the architect is doing. Okay? The project. The project is the total construction of which the work is performed under the contract documents. So the project concludes, and for the owner, as they think about it, oh, I got to hire an architect. I got to buy the land. I got to pay my accountant. I got to do all this other stuff. I got to get landscaping because that might not be under this work. So the project is the biggest umbrella under which the work is one smaller, a large umbrella, and then the services for the architect is another umbrella, and then they have all this going down underneath that. Drawings. The drawings are the graphic, and they generally include plans, elevations, sections, details, schedules, diagrams, etc. You guys all know what drawings are, but here it's now been defined as a term. And so what you'll see is when you get into certain things, like shop drawings are not the drawings, so they aren't considered a contract document. 1.1.6, the specifications. The specifications are the written instructions. And what you're going to see when you get out there and practice, the specifications are going to come in two different ways. Sometimes there's going to be a cover sheet or two or three to the actual drawing that has all this written text on it. And it'll be broken up into different sections for concrete and for plumbing and for electrical and for lighting and for rough carpentry and finished carpentry and everything else. And they'll have a bunch of written words on it, and those are the instructions or the specifications. For your larger projects, they're going to be a separate specification book. I've looked at specification books that are over 2,000 pages long, so for very complex power plants and facilities like that. So there's everything from one page of specifications on a set of drawings for maybe a housing addition all the way to a multi-thousand page document for power plants or something very complicated. So that's another definition. And then here we find finally at 1.1.7 the instruments of service. And it says our representations in any medium of expression. So anything that the architect does, whether it's a drawing, whether it's a computer-rendered drawing, whether it's a painting, whether it's a model, any expression of the now known or later developed, because the instruments of service can continue on. You could do some sketches of what this house is going to be, and then if it doesn't go further, and as I gave the example, one of the clients I represented had a house that was a series of concentric circles. And then the owner didn't hire him, and then a couple years later he sees his house on the cover of a magazine having won an award. Those were his instruments of service, even those were his sketches, and the owner violated the copyright by taking them. So it's in now known or later developed of the tangible and intangible, even if they didn't completely write it down, but you can see what's going on, creative work performed by the architect and the architect's consultants. It's strange to me that the instruments of service is defined in this agreement, but not in the B101. Frankly, if I had the chance to tell them what they need to do, they should put the same definition in both documents. Because this is specifically speaking to the architect. Why don't we just have it in there so we don't have to get confused? But it is out there. It's important. But this is a provision that is more relevant to the architect and the contractor. But it's important the contractor knows what it means, because the contractor will be using those drawings, and they are bound by the requirements that they can't infringe on the instruments of service in any capacity. You don't want to have a contractor take your drawings and continue to work on a project and not get paid and not pay the architects. You know, that happens too. Architects are not the only people that steal from other architects. Contractors steal from designers, so, or developers.
So if there's a law, these definitions have to be looked at.
Yes.
But if there's a law between the architect and the owner,
yes.
This document says the architect did not sign has to be
referenced. Yes. Well, what happens is there's a provision in the B101 that says the defined terms in this document, and we as the basic rules of contracting, a defined term is a capitalized term, not just simply at the beginning of the sentence, but in the middle of the sentence. So drawing, specifications, instrument services. There's a provision in the B101 that says the definitions of the defined terms in this document are in the A201 and shall have the exact same meaning here. So if I'm writing a brief between an owner and an architect, and I want a reference of what the definition of the instruments of service is to say that, that my copyright was violated. I represent the architect. I'm saying that this owner stole my drawings and is trying to build this building elsewhere. I would use instruments of service are defined as blah, 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 blah. And I would cite this document and say, see the A201. If I really wanted to get hyper-technical, I could also cite the provision in the B101 that says, look to the A201. But because the B101 already says those definitions are to be read the exact same way here, that's your crossover for that. So, but that's a really good question. So, okay, initial decision maker, 1.1.8. Now, the initial decision maker is an interesting provision. It has had controversy. It's been in now two sets of the AAA. It was in the 07s, and it's now in the 2017s. There was concepts of it in the 97s, but the point of the initial decision maker is we're trying to, if there's a dispute between the parties, and again, it's defined in here because it would be traditionally a dispute between owner and contractor, we want to have a step process. Instead of us all just run to court right away, let's have a step process. So the first process is, if there's this dispute between the parties, the architect is going to be wearing the white hat, independent neutral, and will be the initial decision maker between the dispute between the owner and the contractor. If that doesn't work, then what happens is you go to mediation or arbitration or litigation, which is going to be, we'll talk about that later in the next week because it's in the later part of the document, but we talked about it in the B101, same dispute resolution process. The reason why the initial decision maker provision and the concept has had some controversy is because frequently the dispute between the owner and the contractor is born out of drawings created by the architect. So the architect will, of course, protect their drawings and say, my drawings are fine, it's the contractor's inability to read them, and so there's a bias in the favor of the architect or even in the favor of the owner. So there is it creates this lack of trust from this. It's a good idea by the AAA to see if we can get this process where it's not the owner and the contractor just fighting against each other. But it doesn't necessarily have the most successful results. As a result, many contracts, whether it's the contractor speaking up or the architect speaking up, they want this provision stricken because they don't want to wear that hat. They want to be able to know which side they're on, whether it's not or everything else. I would say, unless I am asked by one of the parties that the initial decision maker should be the architect, I strike it always. That's just something you guys can take as you get out there and work in it. Sometimes, but as it's drafted here, and it's drafted in the B101, it's automatic that the architect's the initial decision maker, and that's part of your basic services. You don't even get extra money to have to wear the white hat. So it's not the greatest place to be, and that's why a lot of architects step out of it because they put themselves in controversy. Question?
So 1.1.8 is like guaranteed that the architect will be the initial decision maker?
So this provision talks about initial decisions, so that it doesn't have the name of it in here. When you get to Article 15, which we won't do until next week, 15.2 says, unless otherwise stated, the architect shall be the initial decision maker. And then in Article 3.6.4, I think, in the B101, it says the architect is the initial decision maker unless otherwise notified. So it's, they're kind of opposite, but it they basically say elsewhere. So here it doesn't define the name, but elsewhere in both provisions, the architect is already stuck with being wearing the white hat. So Article 15 is all about claims and how you figure out disputes and everything else. That's the second, that's the last article in the entire contract. So we'll get there eventually. But that's a good question because it doesn't say here. You're right. So, but it is the white hat individual. Sometimes you hire an independent third company, like an owner's representative, who may be biased to the owner, but they don't have skin in the game of whether the drawings are bad or the contractor did bad or the owner's being unreasonable, because they can step back and look at everything. In fact, often what you're going to have with the initial decision maker and there's a dispute is both the architect and the contractor are in the controversy. Now you have to have that third party because neither of them are white hat neutrals. So, 1.2.1.2.1, the correlation and intent of the contract documents. The intent of the contract documents as a whole, C capital D, is to include all items necessary for the proper execution and completion of the work by the contractor. Now you're going to see the B101 contract documents are referred to all the time, but again, this is a direction to saying everything in the contract documents is what the contractor needs to build this. And so if the architect hasn't supplied everything, the contractor can raise their hand and say, I need more information, request for information or a change order. I need all these things, not just drawing specification, but the kind of universe of whatever that might be, so I can properly construct the building. And then it says, the performance by the contractor shall be required only to the extent consistent with the contract documents and reasonably inferable for them as being necessary to produce the indicated results. What does that mean? So as we talked about, the architect is not going to always, the architect will never create a set of drawings that covers every single thing 100%. It's not required under your standard of care. It's not required under standard. When you draw an elevation of an interior wall, you're going to show where the windows are, or maybe there's some cabinetry on it. You don't have to draw in each and every spot where there's an outlet. Because on other drawings, there's just going to be an X with a circle around it, a circle with slashes, or three slashes, or however you're going to be doing the definition, you know, the drawing reference of that. And it's a location where then when you get in, the contractor's going to be like, it looks about right here. Like, you're never going to have everything exact. And so that's when it talks about what's reasonably inferable from the drawings. Sometimes you're going to have repeated floors, where the layout from floor to floor to floor is the same. You don't have to draw every single floor. You draw the regular floor and say, see this for the other ones. What's reasonably inferable, and whatever the contractor has to do to match that going up, that's what's reasonably inferable. So while the contractor says, I need all of these contract documents, this universe to build it, there's also an obligation on the contractor to be like knowledgeable in the construction industry. I understand what these symbols mean. I understand what this is. I know what I can go out and what I have to bid. But there can be, when we get into some of the disputes, I had a case, or some of the disputes where the contractor says, it's not reasonably inferable. I couldn't tell from these drawings what I was supposed to bid, so I didn't bid enough, and so I need more money. I need a change order because they're not enough in the drawings. That could be a dispute. Or you could argue, well, it is reasonably inferable. Get back to it. I had a case where I represented an owner who developed projects in conjunction with the federal government. And there was a set of Army barracks that they were putting together. And the Army barracks had a certain number of floors, and there was a certain number of barracks, and there was a certain type of floorboard material, and there was specifications that talked about it. But not every single floor and every single element of all these buildings were designed. There was enough information. And the contractor underbid the project by about 30% because what we argued was you just left a floor out in each building. There was three floors, they were all three-story buildings, and you bid it for two stories, and it's a three-story. It was, in our opinion, it was really simple. If you looked at the map, he just consistently only bid two-thirds of what was necessary. He tried to come back and argue that that wasn't clear, wasn't this and that, blah, blah, blah. And the argument we made was based on this. It's reasonably inferable. It's drawn as a three-story building. You've seen what the barracks are supposed to be. You need to bid all three floors. You can't just do two. That was a simple case, but it can get much more complex depending on what the drawings are. Questions on that? Okay. 1211, we're talking about the contract documents. If it is determined that any provision of the contract documents violates any law, so remember we talked about void and voidable and invalid, or otherwise invalid or unenforceable. So here we have void, invalid, unenforceable. Those are the, remember we had the different categories here. Then that provision shall be revised to the extent necessary to make it legal and enforceable. And then the contract documents shall be construed to the full extent permitted under the law. The purpose of this provision is very much not to do with construction, but very much to do with contract drafting as a lawyer. I want to make sure that if I draft this contract and something is not correct under the law, which we make mistakes, you guys make mistakes, owners make mistakes, contractors, everything else. If I have it properly drafted, or maybe the law changed from when I put this contract together to when it was actually used. I mean, the AIA documents are out there for 10 years. There's plenty of changes in the law. This provision is to say if something is void under the law or unenforceable, we can excise that out. We can just take those sentences out. We can correct them to make them legal, or we just remove them. But it doesn't make the entire contract invalid. So we can go from piece to piece. It's like a line item correction ability. So that's a saving grace, because if you think about it, if I put a contract together and it's a couple million dollar project, and contractors out there working and they find out that there's a couple provisions that are now illegal, you don't want them to be able to walk away. You don't want to be able to have them rebid the project and make your project price go up. You want to have the rest of the contract stay intact. So this allows this to happen. Skipping down to 1, 2, 3, unless otherwise stated in the contract documents, words that have well-known or technical or construction industry meanings are used in the contract documents in accordance with such recognized meanings. So this is the part where it says, while I know that defined terms have to be capitalized, we're all in the same construction industry world. So if I'm using the term, I don't know, piping or laminated beam or whatever the terms you're using, we don't have to capitalize every single one. So that applies a lot to the specifications and the written language you're going to see in the various ones. This says, hey, you guys are construction people. You should know what this means. You should understand what this is for. So we can have some defined terms that don't have a capitalization. 1.3 talks about capitalization, but I need to get to it. 1.4 talks about interpretation. So there's some of these ones, there's language, I just skipped it over and just wanted to go into it. 1.5, ownership and use of the drawings, specifications, and other instruments. If you remember, we had the whole Article 7 that talked about who owned what and licenses and everything else. And this basically gives the headlight to the contractor. Something's gone on over there, you need to follow it here. And it says, the architect and the architect's consultant shall be deemed authors and owners of their respective instruments of service. That's almost word for word from the very first, from 7.1 of the B101. Including the drawings and specifications, and retain all common law, statutory, and other reserve rights in the instruments of service, including copyrights. So this is, like I said, it's a warning. It's a recognition to the contractor. These aren't your drawings. You guys are just getting the opportunity to use them. Don't steal them because they're owned by somebody else. It doesn't have to go into all the remaining provisions that are found in Article 7. It has some here, a few more things, and it actually, but you don't have to get into great detail because they've already put on notice. Somebody else owns these drawings. 1.2, contractors, subcontractors, subsystems, suppliers, blah, 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 they're authorized to use and reproduce the instrument services provided to them, subject to any protocols established in Section 1.3 and 1.8, we'll talk, or 1.7 and 1.8, solely and exclusively for the use of this work. So, the execution of work. Solely and exclusively is also used in the B101, where the owner can solely and exclusively use it for this project. So it's, again, a warning to the contractor. Owners have been told what they can use it for. You get the chance to use them, but only solely and exclusively. So that's the discussion about the copyright. That's all we have. There's just two provisions, as opposed to the four or five that are in the Article 7. A lot more in that one. Notice. Notice is an important element in any contract, in any relationship. It's the communication between the parties. And you have to tell someone if something's gone wrong, or you have questions to ask, or if you need to be payment. There's all this stuff that goes back and forth. It's not we sign the contract, we stick it in the drawer, and then we go build the building, and nobody talks to each other. But for certain provisions in the agreement that are important, you have to give specific and proper notice. Notice with a capital N. And so notice in here is defined of who's doing what. A lot of times in a contract, you're going to be on the site, you're going to be talking to the architect back and forth. What do you think about this? You're going to sketch some stuff out and everything else. That's not going to require notice. But other things will. Change orders, timing of stuff. And so it says, other than provided in 162, which we'll talk about in a second, where the contract documents require one party to notify or give the other party, such notice shall be provided in writing. Now, this is a little bit of a change from what all AIA contracts had been before. The AIA contracts before, it didn't say that notice, when it's critical, had to be in writing as a general statement that applies to the entire document. Because it's up front in general provisions, it applies to the entire contract. If you take a look at the B107, the A201 from the 2007s or the 97s, there'll be provisions throughout the agreement that says notice is required in writing. Notice is required in writing. Now if you see the word notice in this document, you know from this provision that it must be in writing. So they've taken it and said we're applying it to everything as opposed to just the specific paragraphs that we called out before. And that was because there would be arguments where sometimes you get in and the owner says, I didn't get proper notice, and the contractor would point to the contract and say, this paragraph doesn't require me to give written notice. The other ones do, so it doesn't apply to this one. Another part of construction contract drafting is, if you highlight it in specific paragraphs, it doesn't apply to the other ones. When you put it as a general provision, it applies to all. Did you have a question?
Yeah, so like, there was that question about a return that is like, somebody puts in the contract that all changes and amendments made to the contract needs to be in writing.
Yeah.
And then there was like an oral agreement.
Right.
And the oral agreement is still valid and then like that.
Yes.
So there's a general provision that says that there needs to be a notice in writing and somebody provides a notice orally. Is that still valid?
It is not, because notice is not a change to the contract, it's providing information. But if you change the contract to say, I want you to build something else, like a change order, hey, it's going to go from 2-bedroom to 3-bedroom, that's a change to the contract which overrides that statement that says changes must be in writing, because the two parties have agreed this change is not going to be in writing. Where, and I know it's confusing. I mean, we can say to each other, hey, let's just do notice only by email. Or we can talk to each other on the phone. I want you to do this. This counts as my notice. And you say that counts as my notice. That then overrides for that specific one. It doesn't change it for the overall general. But when we're doing a change order, because we know that we're changing the contract scope as opposed to how we communicate, that's why you can do it in that one. So I know it's frustrating. I mean, like, I see your face. You're like, you're killing me here. But it doesn't seem like it makes sense.
So it's sort of the notice is that it has to be a written agreement if you agree that it's a written agreement, but for a contract change, it can be an oral agreement even if you agree that it has to be a written agreement.
Yeah. Try to think of it this way. The change order is a change to the scope of services of what you're doing. Okay? So that's the underlying intent of the contract. The notice is how you communicate that change. So if you have this oral communication between each other, but the intent is the change order, that change order can, for that transaction, change the requirement for the notice to be in writing as long as you've communicated. But it doesn't change it for the overall. Notice still does that. So I guess in a hyper-technical, when I'm asking you to do a change order and you say we agree, that notice has been waived for that provision, but it doesn't apply to changing a communication methodology for the rest of the agreement. Does that make it better? Understand a little better? It's not the easiest thing to do, and the way the courts, and this is more about how the courts interpret it, as far as they're going to be more strict on the concept of notice being in writing, because they're going to want to see that, even though that change order isn't in writing. But if the work is done and someone has performed services and is deserved to be paid for those services, the court's going to say, that's a scope thing. I'm going to protect the person that actually expended time and money. And I'm going to support that oral change so the owner can't skate out on paying for that $20,000 expedition and hold that change and say, I know it says it has in writing, but you guys agreed to that. Whereas a notice of saying how we communicate about it doesn't necessarily change, doesn't affect their scope or their money. So, and it's more like an equity thing. And I will tell you this, though. There are plenty of times, there's an article, we'll get into it, in Article 14 that talks about notice. We'll get there eventually next week. The courts blow off the notice provision in writing all the time. So, and I'll point that out to you. So there's, as you, if you get into it and you do my profession instead of doing what your profession is, and I'm not necessarily saying anybody should go be a lawyer, but if you decide to do that, you will learn as you practice, sometimes notice provision doesn't count, sometimes the change order, written change order doesn't count. You just, I don't want to break that. You just start to learn that. And then you also learn what judges are going to go a little bit more leeway this or that. I was just talking to one of my colleagues yesterday, and she had a slam dunk, dead to rights, default judgment against the party. They came back and moved to have the default vacated, meaning wiped out, give me another chance. They were 90 days late. The law says 30 days. I mean, it wasn't even close. They hadn't showed up to court. And the court was like, vacation granted, come back in. So like sometimes the judges are like, we're just trying to be fair here. So it's not perfect, but it's a great question you asked about that. So, okay. Moving on. Notice of claims is provided, and this is where you're going to see your issues. Notice of claims provided in Section 15.1.3 shall be provided in writing, which it says, and to the notice addressed by certified or registered mail or courier or proof of delivery. Sometimes you're going to find a court that will say, oh, you got an email? Owner, that's enough for this claim, even though it says certified mail. Per this contract, though, it's going to be certified mail. Just as an example, if you're going to be in federal court, the federal court's going to enforce this as written. Some states' court will, some won't. But the point here is if I'm a contractor and I have a claim, to keep myself out of trouble, I follow this. You know, and even with a change order, if I get a change order, to my contractor, I put it in writing because I want to be able to not have to worry about later going on. It's not to say that the courts won't help you out, maybe, but that's what something you want to do. So these rules are in place to give you guidelines and to protect yourself. So, 1.7, digital data. This talks about how, because you guys are all doing anything electronic, if there's any degradation or loss of some of the information in the actual documents that are being transferred electronically, this is that you'll develop a protocol of what happens and who's responsible for what. Where I often see, in addition to this provision here, and there's more information, like people add and say, the only documents that are relevant are the ones that are paper copies. So, yes, we give you digital documents and you can use those and it's put up on a project website and everything else, but we're still going to print out and send you a set of drawings to build from that. That's the only one that really are the drawings and specifications for the contract documents. This digital stuff we're still worried about. This has been in this agreement for 30 years. I don't know how much it really comes up. I always have a digital data protocol in my agreements to make sure we're all safe. But I have had, in my career, zero cases where the information got lost between the electronic transfer. I'm sure they're out there because the provision still exists, but I have never had to litigate one of those. 1.8, building information models. I don't know if you guys heard of BIM, building information models. And what happens, like, and I actually been negotiating this provision in the B101, because there's a similar provision in the B101 about this. BIM is something where it's information that you get to figure out how buildings are put together and everything else. But this one basically says you cannot rely on that as the contract documents. It's not the proper source material. It's an additional tool for building and transmitting information, but we still must rely on the drawings, capital D, and specifications, capital S. Okay, any questions on that? That's Article 1, the general provisions. That applies to every single thing in the rest of the contract. It floats down, so we have to say notice again in writing, we have to say what BIM is again. It's everything that now we're reading is in context with respect to this in mind. Okay, Article 2 is now the obligations of the owner. So, there's a definition of the owner. They got to present in 221 who's going to be the representative, who has the express authority. So this is this agency part, and it identifies how we're going to do that. And then it says, except as otherwise provided in section 421, the architect does not have such authority. You guys remember in the B101 it said, unless specifically stated otherwise, the architect has no authority. So you only in that agreement where it calls it out. Here it only says one provision. So we know that there's only one spot in the A201 where when the architect speaks, the contractor has to listen because this architect's speaking on behalf of the owner. So 221, evidence of the owner's financial arrangements, and 222, which is going to be on the next slide. These are two provisions that, depending on who you represent, will come or go. But the purpose of these two provisions is the contractor, for understandable reasons, is allowed to say, hey, I'm going to do this multi-million dollar project for you. Can you prove to me you have the money? That's effectively what 2.1 says. And this happens before they sign this agreement, before the construction contractor start doing it. And the owner has to provide reasonable evidence that they have financial arrangements to build this. Contractor can say, I'm not signing this unless I know you got the cash. Seems pretty fair. 2.2, a little more detail, is if something happens during the course of the project. I know you told me you had the $10 million now, but now it's going to be a $14 million project because you keep coming back to me with changes, or the hole we dug had really bad soil, or there's this huge increase in price of differences because of supply chain or whatever else has come up. I need to make sure you have the additional $4 million. So you could ask here, and this talks about following the written request, I can see what the additional financial information's for. They got to identify the reasonable concern. So there's some rules of when you can ask for it in the middle of the project. And then it says in the second part, however, a request is made because a change in the work materially changes the contract sum under three above. The contractor may immediately stop only that portion of the work affected by the change. So if you have concerns because we've added on an additional bedroom or bathroom to the project, you can say, I'm not working on that portion until you show me you have the money for that, but you still have to work on the rest of it. So you can't shut it down. If it's been some of the other things up above, you may be able to shut the project down until you get that notice. Now, the reason why I said this provision sometimes is in and sometimes are out, you will find many owner clients that do not want to give up their information. So I've had large companies, like Microsoft doesn't need this. They're like, well, Microsoft, you can't look at my books. I'm not going to give you my information. You do work with me or not. They don't even need this. They say, so I just strike it for certain clients. Other clients will request me to strike that. Some clients will say, if we have this financial information, it must be only reviewed by some special person, and it has to be marked private and privileged and confidential so nobody else can see that. So there's modifications made as to what has to be released for sometimes, and you as the architect may be asked about that to get that information from the owner to the contractor. So it's not always cut and dry. But by and large, for just your normal project, this is what comes through. 223, after you give the financial information to the under the section 2.2, the owner shall not materially vary such financial arrangements without prior notice to the contractor. So if you're going to refinance your loan, maybe it's a simple one saying bank and it's just you're getting better interest terms, which often happens, that's not a substantial change to it or material change to it because it only affects you. But if you decide, well, originally we were going to put 10% down or 30% down of our own money and the other 70% is financed, now we're only going to put 10% down and we're financing another 20%, that may be something where you have to ask, you have to notify the contractor to see where the finances are coming from. And it's a kind of case-by-case basis to see if you need to do that. 224. When the owner's designated information person under this section confidential, then it needs to be held under confidential language. And there's a provision later on that we're going to talk about how confidential information is handled and what they need to do with it, and how they mark it and otherwise. But that's part of the information you as an owner or contractors may need to give confidential information. Design professionals may need to give confidential information. All these documents include language that protects that information from being disseminated to the public. And then they also should include, after the project is over, that the documents are either returned or destroyed. So some contractor's not sitting with an owner's private financials for 10 years and can just disclose them elsewhere. Somebody can walk off with them. So there's checks and balances for that confidential information. Article 2.3, under 2.3.1, this is, talks about additional information for services required of the owner. So the owner, not just the architect and not just the contractor, the owner has to do stuff when they build a project. So in this one, it talks. This is what you have to do. It specifically says, so the owner here shall secure and pay for necessary approvals, easements, assessments, and charges related to construction, occupancy permits, permit changes in the existing facilities. So if you want to think about it, basically the owner, if there needs to be the ability to work on the land, if you need to change the zoning, if you need to pay some type of cost to the city for a curb cut because you need to put a driveway in, all those types of things, the owner has to secure both the permits and the information and the approvals from the city, and to the extent there are fees to get those approvals, the owner is responsible for that. Sometimes you'll change this to say, I want the contractor to take care of everything, or an owner's rep will do that, but at least we know from the basic agreement, the owner has to do those types of things. 3.2.3, you have to engage a lawfully licensed architect. Well, that's a shocker, right? Make sure you want to have just not somebody that's not licensed to do this. You've got to bring in a license. And you're thinking to yourself, well, again, this is just so basic. Why is this here? Well, somewhere along the line, there was litigation over whether the architect was licensed or not. I've had that case where he was licensed in 27 jurisdictions, but not in the state of Illinois. The company wasn't. He was. And so they weren't licensed. Well, then the problems with the contract are, I don't have to pay your money back because you didn't hire a licensed architect. So it's simple, but it needs to be in there. 2.3.4. The owner shall furnish surveys describing the physical characteristics, legal limitations of the utilities, blah, blah, blah. So that's saying, here's my plot of land. You can't go over this property line. Here's where the power lines are coming in. Here's where the sewer, here's where the gas lines are. So that information you need to give to the contractor before they start building. And then it goes further that says the contractor is able to rely on the accuracy of these. I'm not being hired to do your underground investigation. I'm not doing soil samples. I'm not walking out there. They have these machines, actually, they use that are x-ray machines. You can go up and down properties to see what's below. They penetrate a certain distance. It's pretty cool. One of my experts uses them all the time. I'm not being hired to do that as a contractor. What you give me, I can rely on. Years ago, probably almost going on probably 28, 29 years ago, I had a call from one of my, he was a brand new partner at the time, he's one of my current partners still, and he's like, you got to get out, it was a Saturday morning, it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and he's like, you got to get out to this project site right now, I'm here, and I'm like, what was going on? And what happened was, is they were redeveloping some buildings down, like in the Division and Clybourne area, and they had the plans of the survey of what was on the ground underneath, and it didn't have the right location for the gas line. They struck a gas line and it sparked and there was this spew of flame going 30, 40 feet in the air. And they were waiting for the gas company to shut it down, but they had to cordon everything off. And so we as the attorneys for the owner developer had to get in there right away to make sure we were assessing what was going on immediately for that, you know, for the major emergency, because there was of course going to be a lawsuit and everything else. And one of the things that came up was, were our drawings accurate, because the contractor relied on the accuracy. And it actually came down to a question of whether they went down in the right place or not. I honestly don't remember how we resolved it. It probably was settled, but this provision is relevant in the sense that owner has to give you where stuff is, and the contractor can rely on that. 2.3.5. The owner shall furnish information or services required of the contract documents with reasonable promptness. So you have to give stuff to keep the project moving along. Now the interesting thing about here, and this is just a side note, I'm not a fan of using the word reasonable in contracts unless it's in specific circumstances. I would say here, it's maybe, maybe not. You could say they need to promptly turn that around. Because what's going to happen is if they don't turn it around in a sufficient period of time and there's a delay on the project, you're going to start fighting back and forth about what the promptness is. You're going to start automatically saying, well, was a week reasonable or not? So you don't need the word reasonable promptness because that's going to be a question of what prompt means, ultimately is, as opposed to saying they need to get information within 7 or 10 days, where it's specific. So reasonable is a tool to make more arguments. Lawyers love it. I just had an agreement that had three, in the one sentence, used the word reasonable three times. I'm like, I don't even know what this sentence says anymore. Because like everything's supposed to be reasonable. Like, what was reasonably adequate? I'm like, isn't adequate enough? What's reasonably adequate? Does it mean it's adequate means you've got to come to just like just enough. So is reasonably adequate below just enough? Or is it more like I was like, this is crazy. So you can do some stuff like that. But what here, the important point of this provision is the owner's got to turn things around. They can't just kind of sit on their hands and knees. They got to keep the project moving just like the contractor and the architect does. 2.4. Owner's right to stop the work. This provision is actually quite important. I've used this on behalf of the owner many times. Well, I won't say many times. Enough times that I've litigated about it. I know the case law and everything else. The point of 2.4, and then we'll get 2.5 as well, is if the contractor, first instruction, if the contractor fails to correct the work. So that by itself means that you've pointed out a defect for the contractor first. It's not we build it improperly and you just go ahead and stop the work. The owner has an obligation to tell the contractor what they screwed up. And if they fail to correct the work, repeatedly fails to carry out the work in accordance with the contract documents. So there's a second time, maybe over and over and over, you forget that you don't make schedule, you do things over and over and over. So these are parameters that must happen before you can invoke 2.4. The owner may issue a written order to the contractor to stop the work or any portion thereof until the cause for such order has been eliminated. So what you can say to the contractor is, I've given you like three chances to do this and you failed to correct it, or you just keep late, you're late, you're late, you're late. I can't deal with this anymore, so I can either stop the entire project, or what happens more often is that one area gets stopped until there's a solution. And the solution can be in 2.5, which I'm going to show in a second, but it's a provision that gives the owner a pretty big hammer because now the contractor's not going to get paid for any of this work. And it's going to affect the contractor's schedule overall because of a ripple effect. That's all still going to be the contractor's, largely the contractor's fault because they haven't been able to correct things. So this is it's not quite the nuclear option of terminating the contractor or firing them, but it is a pretty big deal. And I've seen owners, I've advised owners on this. I wouldn't say go 2.4 them right away. But after a few times and you're not trusting them, you do this to protect your project, to protect your money, and to get the project kind of back on scale, back on track. Now, what's 2.5? Well, 2.5 says if they neglect or to carry out, or to, I'm sorry, default or neglect to carry out the work in accordance with the contract documents, and fails within a 10-day period after the receipt of the notice, so you've given the 2.4 notice, and now we've got 10 days for them to start doing something, the owner can come in without prejudice, meaning without any harm to them, and have other remedies. So if you have a project where something's going south and you give the contractor a chance to fix it, and fix it again, and they can't fix it, or they keep not putting enough men on the project or workers on the project, you send them the 2.4 notice letter, and if the contractor hasn't started doing something about it within 10 days, you can bring in your own team. I had a project out, we had to do this in Navy Pier. Navy Pier, there was a bunch of problems with some electrical work. And we gave the electrician, the contractor who talked to their subcontractor over and over and over. There was multiple times trying to fix this electrical issue. Couldn't do it. We brought in our own electrical contractor. They fixed it. It cost quite a bit more money than what we were supposed to pay the contractor to do that work. So part of our lawsuit was, and I don't remember the numbers, but let's say it was, we were going to pay the contractor $100,000 and it turned out to be $250,000. Part of our lawsuit was, you owe us $150,000 because you promised to do it for $100,000. You couldn't do it. We gave you multiple chances. We sent you a 2.4 letter. And then we sent you 2.5. You still couldn't do it within 10 days, started fixing it. So we brought in our own team. And that's what it says, without prejudice to the owner. The owner can come in, fix it, and not have them say, well, the delay is your fault or otherwise. Question back here.
The letter is 10 days for them to begin fixing it? Or?
So that's a great question. This language does not say begin fixing it, but what you're going to find is in almost all negotiations, whether it's this document or not, somebody's going to write in to complete, commence or complete. And so they'll start the commence language in there. That one, as an owner, I will always give, because that means they're going to really step it up and hopefully it'll work. But if they can't commence and they're doing something, they're still screwing around with it, you don't have to do 2.5 again. You can say, well, you said you commenced it, but you're not doing anything, so I'm going to invoke it anyway. So, but it's not, the language commence or complete is not in here. So, and then the part here, this is the part at the end, was what I'm talking about, the money. It says that if the current or future payments are not sufficient to cover the amounts that I have to pay my electrical contractor, the contractor has to pay the difference. And if the contractor disagrees with the owner, the architect, the amounts of claims can be filed under Article 15. So we can say, our contractor's like, I'm not paying you the $150,000, which is what they said. And then we went to Article 15, and there was claims against each other, claims with a capital C, and then we had litigation. And the litigation went on for 2+ years, and we ultimately settled the case. But there was lots of issues that came up because there was lots of problems on this project. But we 2-4 and 2-5 them. So, and that happens, like I said, I've not done it a lot of times, but it's happened enough in my career that it's an important provision to remember when you're out there. And interestingly enough, if you're an independent decision maker, if you are the architect, the IDM, this is where one of the places you're going to have to come in and say, did the owner properly follow 2.4 and 2.5? Did the contractor improperly correct its work? These provisions would require whoever is wearing that white hat to come in first to give their opinion. It may not settle it, but that's the first place you would step in under these two provisions. All right, that's everything from the owner. Questions on that? Okay. Article 3 is the longest one, so we're going to go through some of it, and we'll give you guys a break. Then we'll come back, we'll finish 3 and 4, and then, like I said, I'm sure we're going to be running out of time by then. So, general provision, definition of what a contractor is under 331, 312, the contractor's going to perform the work, so just some basic stuff there. 313, the contractor shall not be relieved of its obligation to perform the work in accordance with the contract documents, either by the activities or duties of the architect, the architect's administration of the contract, or by test inspections approvals. What this is saying is, remember, so the only time the architect is wearing the owner's hat is in 412. Nothing else that the architect does on this project relieves you, contractor, from your duties under this contract. There may be something that the architect does under 412. When we get there, you can see what it is that allows the contractor to say, hey, I didn't have to do that because the architect told me, which is like the owner. But the reality is the contractor can never raise his hand and say, I didn't have to do this because the architect told me I didn't have to do this. Or I didn't have to do this because this is what was wrong with the architect's drawings. The contractor has an obligation to ask questions. What was reasonably inferable? So this provision is a warning to the contractor. Don't go hiding behind the architect because you can't do it. 321. Execution of this contract by the contractor is a representation that they have visited the site, became generally familiar with the local conditions, and correlated personal observations with requirements of the contract documents. Now, interestingly enough, even though it says this, there are a number of many contracts where the contractor doesn't visit the site first. Like, I know what the property is. We're going to dig a hole and put a house there. Like, I don't need to go there. And then problems come up, and it says, well, you signed this. And you went, why do you go? Well, that's not my problem, because you have a verb, you have stated under the contract you visited the property line, and you can't tell me that you didn't know this, that you didn't see this or that. I had a case years ago where it was problems. It was the development of a school, in addition to a school, high school, junior high. And there were bad soils, And everybody knew that when it was bad weather and rain, it was always muddy in this area. The contractor never went there. And so they had, when they started digging the holes into everything else, the soil was just, it was muck and it was bad. And you have to do what's called dewatering. So you have to remove water and you have to put different types of chemicals in there to shore it up. You have to bring in other types of soils. So there was a huge expense. And the contractor was like, this needs, we should get paid for all this. We should get a change order. And we had people from the school superintendent, we had people that had been there for years, all talk about it. We all knew this area was a swamp. You're responsible for it, whether you visited the site or not. So that's what this provision talks about. Oh, and the correlation of your personal observations, then when you can go out and you see this area where it's all mucky and swampy, and the drawings don't say that, and the soil samples don't say that, it's your obligation to raise your hand and say, what I saw on site doesn't match what you've given to me. I'm supposed to be rely on the accuracy of what you gave to me, but it doesn't exactly where I think what happened out there. So it can be a reason for the contractor, if they did do their job, to get either a change order or ask for something to protect them. So, 322, contractor shall, before starting each portion of the work, carefully study and compare the various contract documents relative to that portion of the work, so the information furnished by the owner, blah, 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 take field measurements and any existing conditions required of the portion related to any of that portion of the work, and shall observe any conditions of the site affecting it. So now we're actually on the site. Whether you visited it before you signed the contract or not, now you're on the site, and here's some things that you have to do. You have to take field measurements. If you think that the plot of survey of land that you got is wrong, and you've gone out and you've done your own survey, and you think, or you think that the way the architect has drawn the building and it's going to be too close to the lot line or what have you, you as the contractor have to do your own investigation to make sure that they're accurate from what you're observing, and raise your hand when you come back and tell the owner, hey, I've seen something here in my own field measurements that are not consistent or accurate. Interestingly enough, when we did the Navy Pier project, there are the second part of this provision we entirely rewrote because of what the owner wanted. And I would often do this, even though we didn't use the AIA documents when I represented McCormick Place, we would also modify the second part of the provision because the owner wanted to put all responsibility on the contractor. But that second part, as you see, says that reviewing and coordinating everything else, it's not for the purpose of discovering errors, omissions, and consistency in the contract document. So I'm not looking to see if somebody made a mistake. That's the architect's responsibility or the surveyor's responsibility. But the contractor shall report, but it gives an obligation, shall report to the architect any errors, omissions, or consistency and discovered made by the contractor. So it says if you see something, say something, but your job isn't out there to have to correct that. What we did for Navy Pier and for McCormick Place is we said it is for the purpose of going out and making sure that the drawings we gave you are accurate. If you don't want to rely, or if you think you can't rely on the drawing, on the surveys we've given you, or the soil samples, or the locations of the pipe, whatever it might be, your job is to figure it out and build that into your price. And if you think about the history of Navy Pier, it's 125 years old or something, 125, I think that we just had the celebration. And nobody knows how that thing was built years and years ago, and it's on piers. Nobody knows what's underneath there. So the owners of Navy Pier, the people that were running it and running the project, were like, we don't want to start having to investigate the entire thing for the entire project. The contractor can do that. They can hire those people before they start ripping stuff up. And so they put all the responsibility on the contractors. Made the project more expensive for the contractor to take on that risk, but it still ultimately would have been even more expensive had the owner had to do it because they didn't know where to test or not. Contractor knows exactly what they need in this area. They'll test for that. Same thing when we did projects for McCormick Place. We put all those responsibilities back on the contractor. It was interesting for me because I practiced for probably, maybe 15 years or so by that time. So I've been practicing for a while, 15, 18 years. And I hadn't been working with large-scale public bodies before. So like maybe Pierre McCormick Place or public bodies. And I knew how much this would increase the contracts, the prices. And I'm like, you know, this is something that the public are paying for. And, you know, we can control and manage it if we put these other provisions. I know provisions that help even tighten 322 even more in favor of the owner. And they all were like, no, we're not going to do that because it's just a different perspective on the governmental side of what they want to pass off or put off to the contractor. And as in the years of doing it, many, many years now later, it does make sense in those types of projects to put it on the contractor as opposed to a private owner developing and all the ramifications of change orders and getting additional money from the governmental agencies and bonding and stuff like that. So this is when if I'm doing a public job, I put it more on the contractor. If I'm doing a private job, I may tighten it up on behalf of the owner. 323, the contractor is not required to ascertain that the contract documents are in accordance with applicable laws, statutes, ordinance, codes, and rules and regulations. The architect is the one that did that. You remember in the provisions in the B101 talks about the architect is responsible for codes and regulations and when they send the drawings in for permits. This is the opposite. I don't have to worry about whether those drawings are correct. That's not my job. That's the architect's here. But it says the contractor shall make proper report to the architect any nonconformity discovered made known to the contractor. So he may tell you that it's not a permit, or the contractor knows what permitting is, or what not permits but codes and regulations are. Contractors pretty much know what they have to build because of OSHA being out there and otherwise. So again, this is if you see something, say something. So question over there.
If they're required to report to the architect, does that report have to be in writing Report.
Good question. Is this something? Is this one of the ones where it says notice must be in writing? And the answer to that is technically no, because it doesn't say the contractor must give notice. So if you see the word notice, we know that has to be in writing. This one says you should report. It doesn't say shall notify the architect. So it's a different thing. Now, if I'm a contractor and I see that the reason why, that as a result of this, I'm going to have to pay more money because of the change, then I want to put it in writing so I can document it and everything else. As a prudent thing, you as a contractor want to document all of your stuff, but it's not a requirement under this contract for the notice provision. But that's a great question. 324. If the contractor believes that additional cost or time is involved because of the clarifications or instructions, the contractor shall submit claims as provided by Article 15. So if they're not getting paid, if they say that if the responses to the notices or requests for information, so if they get it back and they're not getting what they want, they think it's supposed to be more money or there's supposed to be a change here and everything else, they can submit it under claims under Article 15. And if the contractor fails to perform the obligations of Section 322 or 323, the contractor shall pay such costs and damage to the owner subject to 15.17 as would it have been if the contractor had performed such obligations. Okay, what does that mean? Well, this means here is under 322 and 323, the contractor has to check the project site out and look at the drawings. And if they see something doesn't make sense, they're not sure what the drawings say, or doesn't match up what's on the project site, you raise your hand, you report it to the architect, you get what's called an RFI, request for information. You send that out. If the contractor has failed to do that, and it ends up costing money later on, because they haven't told the owner or the architect, I got to change how I'm building this, and it's going to cost me more money. If they fail to do that, and they build it, they can't get the money later. They can't bring that claim later under 15.2 and say, oh, by the way, back in October, these drawings were crappy, but I figured it out, and you owe me another $20,000. The owners would be like, you didn't tell me. Had you told me, I would have made the architect change their drawings and not save, and maybe save 20, maybe save 5, whatever it is, but you didn't tell me. So not only is it if you see something, say something, this says if you see something and didn't say something, you don't get paid for it. So word of the wise, and contractors follow this all the time, is they put a lot of stuff in writing. And as a construction lawyer, the biggest headache of construction project construction litigations are the hundreds of thousands of documents that exist on a project. And what you'll find is some contractors are really, really good at it, almost to the point of they start writing those claim letters right away to make up for an underbid, or that's how they make profit on the project. Or you'll find there's going to be certain subs that never document anything, and then you're like, what the hell's going on? Or the architect doesn't keep a good set of notes. So it's not uncommon where you're going to get a boatload of documents from certain trades or contractors or design professionals and not on the others, and you're doing a lot of putting puzzle pieces together. And here 3-2. Okay, 3-3. Supervision of the construction and procedures. The contractor shall supervise and direct all work, and with using their best skill and attention. Now, if we remember, when you were an architect, you were just going to be an ordinary architect. But here, the contractor has to use their best skill and attention. So the concept of the standard of care for the contractor is different than the standard of care for the architect. It's not to say that it's less, it's different. Best skill, because what you're building has to stand up. The wall can't fall down. The lights don't flicker. The air conditioning has to work. These things are all ultimately what's going to be in your warranties and guarantees. You may remember when we talked about the B101, and I've said throughout the semester, architects never guarantee. They never warrant. None of my drawings are perfect. I'm an ordinary architect. It's not to say that you're not doing something very important and that you're, what you're doing can't have risk and liabilities because you have a little more wiggle room the way it's written. But here we know that the contractor must use best skill and attention to the project. That's a different provision. And I think you may remember also when I said, if you're looking at that Article 2.2 in the B101 talking about the standard of care, when somebody puts in the word best or excellent or a superlative like that, strike it, because you only want to be an ordinary architect for that type of project. Going on, this looks exactly like what the architect shouldn't do, because here it says the contractor shall be solely responsible, means, methods, techniques, sequences, procedures, etc., safety and otherwise. So this is, architect, I don't have any responsibility. Contractor, I have sole responsibility. The completely opposite, but it's reminiscent of what you saw in the B101. So that's why these documents work well together. And then if the contractor determines, so there can be some times where the architect may change some stuff, but it says if the contractor determines such means, methods, techniques, blah, 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 may not be safe. Maybe the way it's designed, the contractor still has to figure out how to build it, but they say, I can't build this the way it's designed without it being safe. The contractor should give timely notice, so that would be in writing, to the owner and architect, and shall propose alternatives. I don't like the way you want me to dig this well because it's not safe given the soils. I understand that this is not an uncommon well, but given the soils, it's not safe, so we have to do more shoring and bracing to dig this hole. That would be an example where they give notice, they have to put in more shoring and bracing, they get more money, and then they can move forward. So, the architect here evaluates the proposed alternatives and make sure it's okay and it's conformance with the design intent. I'm going to take a look. Yeah, it seems like what I really wanted to intend it, so we can move on. And then unless the architect objects to that proposed method, so no, it's, you can't do it because it's not, and they don't object because of the safety issue. They object because it's in violation of the design intent. The contractor should perform the work using that alternate means. So let's say we have that hole being dug, and the contractor's concerned about the integrity of the soils, or maybe the building next door is going to potentially, because of its weight, and they're losing this lateral support, the building next door may fall under. So the contractor comes in and does shoring and bracing, and that makes sense to keep it shored up. But that results in losing 2 feet of the foundation of the building they've designed. Well, is the architect going to approve that? If the simple shoring and bracing is going to be done? Probably not. And so the architect can say, well, changing the design intent, because I've lost 2 feet of my foundation. It's going to be 6 inches, maybe not, but 2 feet's a big deal. So there is some wiggle room there, and then the parties go back and figure out, well, what's a different type of solution? Can we do a different shore, how we shore things up to make sure we don't lose the foundation area? That's an example. So, 3.2, the contractor shall be responsible to the owner for the acts or omissions of the contractor's employees, subcontractors, the agent employees, everything under their umbrella. So we have the project as a big umbrella. Now we have, and if you remember, we had those charts, those little flow charts under the alternative project method. So we have the contractor here and all their subcontractors and all the vendors. Anybody that's under the contractor's umbrella, they're responsible for all of it. So when I am an owner and I have a problem with the electrical, I don't sue the electrician, I sue the contractor, and then he talks to the electrician. So that's how it's a one single point responsibility. Owner, contractor. Contractor takes care of all the people down below. 3.4. This talks about labor and materials. We'll jump to 3.4.2. Except in the case of minor changes. And remember, we talked about minor changes on the architect. They can say, well, it's eagle white to dove white, and some of those minor things where the architect can do that. The contractor may make substitutions only with the consent of the owner after evaluation by the architect and in accordance with the change order or construction change directive. So maybe eagle white to dove white may be more than what the architect will allow, but certainly eagle white to mallard green, that's not going to be something that they can do without getting consultation. So that's not a minor change on paint colors. If we're looking at the location of the lighting fixtures and we have to move them a little bit because of the way the structure of the support beams are, the contractor can do a little bit of that as a minor change. But I think I may have told you guys about, I had a house where they had piping that went through, and right over the bar were supposed to be all centered the lights, these installed lights in the ceiling, and they were in a row for a little bit, and then one jogged out for about a foot and a half, and then it came back in a row, and the contractor's like, well, I couldn't put it there because there was plumbing there. And we're like, you needed to fix that. You need to raise your hand about that. That it looked terrible. So we had to figure out how to fix it. You had to rip things out and all this other stuff, and the contractor had to pay for it because they never raised their hand and said, I saw something, I didn't say something. So this is where, and so the concept of minor changes, you have to kind of case by case. And probably if you took the contract I was looking at yesterday, it would say in case of reasonably minor changes. But in any event. 3.4.3. The contractor shall enforce strict discipline and good order among its employees or other persons carrying out the work. You just got to make sure that the site is run clean and safe and efficiently. Larger projects, they'll have safety protocols and everything else. So this is just an obligation. You can't just get a bunch of people running around and crawling all over each other. There's got to be order in this chaos. Warranty. So warranty, as I said, architects never give a warranty. Contractors do. And they warrant to the owner and architect that the materials and equipment furnished under the contract will be of a good quality and new, unless the contract documents require otherwise. So, if you're putting down a hardwood floor, it's got to be new wood. It's not reconstituted. It's not wood you took from the last project you tore up. It has to be new, unless the owner or the architect says, we want a reconstituted floor. We want floor from this barn, whatever it might be. So you can't just come in, and as it said in the last one, you can't just make substitutions either. Oh, I'm going to do this because I want. Contractors do it all the time, but this provision says, I am warranting, I'm guaranteeing you that it's of good quality and new. They will reform the requirements of the contract documents and will be free from defects, except for those inherent in the quality of the work and the contract documents required permit. So again, good and new, and free from defects, unless the contract documents allow them to be something less than that, or something different. The contractor's warranty, and so if warranty is violated, if these things happen, the contractor must come back and fix them for free. If they install the dishwasher into your house, and it doesn't work for the first year of the warranty, we don't care, the contractor must come in, pull that dishwasher, and put a new one in. That's part of the warranty. if it's an air conditioning unit, if it's the way the windows are supposed to go up and down. All the elements that are into this project must be new and good quality, must be free from defects under that warranty. However, the warranty excludes remedy for damage or defect caused by abuse, alterations in the work, and insufficient maintenance, improper operations, and normal wear and tear. I had a project for the federal courthouse building out in Rockford, Illinois, and the contractor installed this roofing system. And so it was supposed to be new and everything else, and it was on a semi-flat roof, but it had a slight pitch to allow drainage, and there was problems with it. So we made a warranty claim onto the contractor to come out and fix it, and he went out, and you could see where there was a bunch of dents in the roof and causing depressions where it shouldn't, so it affected the operation of the roof. He said, this is not covered under my warranty because someone has walked on this roof. It was a light metal, it wasn't aluminum, but it was a light metal installed roof, and it was clear that there had been weights or something. They thought it was somebody walking on it, probably getting to do window work or masonry work or whatever it might be. And so he said, this is not covered by the warranty because it's damaged by someone else. And so we had a little fight about it, but ultimately he was right. And then we went back and found, looking at the sequence of the work going on, we found out who was out doing that, and we went after them and got the money to repair the roof. So, 352, all material, equipment, or other special warranty shall be issued in the name of the owner or shall transfer to the owner. What this means is when the contractor's done, the contractor's going to have its warranty for its work, its labor and installation and all the other people, but anything that's special, like for a piece of equipment or an extended warranty for a roof or other things that may come up after the 1 year where the contractor still has to be around, you want that warranty issued in the owner's name so they don't have to go contract the owner, the contractor. They can just call the supplier of the air conditioners themselves or the roof manufacturer so they can get directly to them and they have the warranty paper in hand. 3.7, permits, fees, notices, and compliance with laws. 3.7.1, the contractor shall secure, so this is the contractor. Remember, the owner had to get surveys and improvements and permissions to be on the land. But here, the contractor secure and pay for the building permit, as well for other permits, fees, licenses, and inspections from government agencies necessary for the proper execution of the work. Now, while it says the contractor's paying for it, remember the owner's always going to pay because the contractors are going to send the bill to them for what they paid. But the reason why the owner was doing surveys and easements and where the project was going to go, why that's on the owner, is because that ties to the land, and the owner owns the land. You can think about it as I own the land, and so I'm responsible for any type of thing, surveys, tests, all the stuff on the land, so I do that work. Give it to the contractor. Contractor's responsible for building it, whatever the construction is. So anything that has to do with that, the contractor understands. So they're going to get the building permit, or they're going to get other things that relate to if there's going to need to be a site setback, if there's going to be other things that happen to do with how the building is being constructed. They know that much better than the owner. They're going to understand when they need to get the electrical permit paid for, or the plumbing permit, or when those inspections are going to happen. They just have that knowledge. So instead of the owner having to do all that, you just tell the contractor, you do it, you pay for it, and we'll pay you back. It just makes things run more smoothly. 3.7.2, the contractor shall apply and give notices required in applicable laws, statutes, ordinance, rules, and regulations. So, while they don't have to look at the drawings to see if the drawings actually comply with rules and regulations, they have to be aware of the rules and regulations with respect to the work the contractor's doing. So that's what Article 3.7.2 says. I can't put my head in the sand entirely. I can ignore it with respect to design. I don't have to do the calculations on the loads. I don't have to figure out if this air conditioning has enough cubic feet of air moving through. That's somebody else figured that out. But on my side, I still have to know what OSHA says and, you know, what we're going to be needing for the city and how we're going to build this, all those types of things. Is there a fence required? What's the fence? Like all those things, the contractor needs to know the laws and regulations. 3.7.3, contractor performs the work knowing If the contractor performs the work knowing it to be contrary to the applicable laws, so if I do something that I know I'm violating the laws, I will assume the appropriate responsibility for such work. So if I do something that's in violation of OSHA, and there's an OSHA fine, the OSHA fine goes to the owner, but the contractor has to pay it. That's what this provision says. So the project gets fined, and the owner has ultimate responsibility, but the contractor has to pay for that. Or if there's other violations that the contractor does, and the owner gets fined, or the contractor could be fined directly, depending on it is, that's what we have there. So 374, concealed or unknown conditions. So this is the stuff where you don't have x-ray vision. If the contractor encounters a condition of the site that are subsurface or otherwise concealed physical conditions or unknown physical conditions from an unusual nature that differ materially from the ordinarily found to exist, blah, 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 the contractor shall promptly provide notice to the owner and the architect before conditions are disturbed, and in no event later than 14 days after the first observance of the condition. Now, obviously, that project I was talking about where they hit the pipe and the flames just started spewing in the air from the gas line, that's something they couldn't have given pre-notice for, but they certainly papered the file intently after that. But maybe you're out there, and as a contractor, you see that the property's not exactly what you want. So there, you start to dig, and you find something. Or, like, sometimes they'll find problems with the soil. Maybe they'll know that the soil, even though we have soil samples, maybe has hazardous materials. I believe I gave you the example of Navy Pier, where that used to be, that area in front of Navy Pier was a dumping ground for radium when they were doing the watches, the glow-in-the-dark watches. And so the contractor stopped, did not continue to disturb that soil. The Illinois EPA and the regular US EPA came in and had to put together a remediation plan. It took about a year for them to go through all that. And then they cleaned it up, and then the contractor got paid for that work. So this is it's saying is you gotta like promptly stop and kind of give some notice. Article 10 we'll talk about later about hazardous materials and things, but this is just anything that differs from what you should expect or what was in the drawings, promptly provide notice. And even if you disturb the conditions, maybe it's because you did a backhoe and you started doing that, you got to give them notice within 14 days of when you did that. And for the contractor, it's important because it's going to slow down their project. So they want to raise their hand and say, hey, there's a delay and it's not my problem, so I don't have to pay for this. In fact, it's going to cost me more money because I got to have workers sitting there. So you're going to be not only paying for what it is to fix this area, but you're going to pay me for sitting around. So, and then it goes on and on and on, and it says that ultimately the architect shall probably notify the owner and the contractor, if you know, depending on what the fix is and everything else, the determination of whether the conditions are the same or not, or whether the drawings match or whatever, under these concealed conditions. And if either party objects to the architect's determination, they can submit a claim under Article 15. So sometimes, after the contractor raises a hand, the architect comes back and says, no, no, what we gave you should show this, reasonably inferable, and there can be a dispute. Or maybe the architect says, we need to go further. So this is a provision that gives you some guidelines of how to solve when the conditions are different than what's expected or what you can see because it's underground or concealed. Concealed could be what's behind walls if you're doing a renovation of an old building. You know, you thought the plumbing was here and it turns out it's in a different location because of the way they built it. Or you open it up and, like, great example I see from time to time is somebody will be, like a contractor will be brought in, a developer buys this old building in some farm area, and they start tearing it off, and then they find that the building used to be a school, and they open it up and there's like chalkboards with drawings on it from like 40, 60, 80 years ago. I've read some cool stories about that. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. And so they had to determine what they wanted to do. Like this one project that had, it was drawings from, they were actually from, I want to say from the Civil War. And there was drawings of Civil War people and everything else that they had found in this old building. And so they ultimately converted the use of that room to be kind of like a museum type room. I don't remember what the full structure was going to be. But nobody knew what was behind because there was like three layers of walls. By the time they finally got to that, there was this cool chalkboard with drawings up on it. It's just kind of neat. So that would be something here where you got to figure out what's the solution. 375, we have these problems. This is talking about burial markers and archaeological sites and wetlands. That comes up. The contract shall immediately suspend any operations that would affect them and shall notify the owner and the architect. There are three things that I always think about when this provision comes up. The first is when they built the original McCormick place on the lake, the one that you guys see from the lake, that first building back in the late 60s, that was the area where they were supposed to put it was an Indian burial ground. And they had to bring in the tribes to relocate those graves to be able to put it up there. So that's the first thing that comes. That always led me to, there used to be shows, CSI shows, there was one for Las Vegas. And there was this murder mystery where they were building up this new casino high-rise, and they found this woman, and the theme of the show was one of the Emmys was like, he was big into film noir, and they found this woman's dead body, and she had been, like, when Vegas was run by the mob, and so they shot the episode in, like, these sepia tones, and the back flashbacks and everything else. It was kind of interesting, but it was, again, a dead body burial ground. And the third one is, I don't know if you guys, it's old, way old, but there's a movie called Poltergeist. You guys ever heard of the movie Poltergeist? If you haven't seen it, what ends up happening is there's this house that's haunted, and the little girl's talking to the ghost on the screen, and she's like, they're here, and the ghost is there, and then they, like, all this stuff comes up, and it turns out that the guy who lives in the house, he was one of the partners of the developers of the subdivision, and as the movie's starting to come to the climax, and they're bringing in all the people in the hazmat suits and everything else, it turns out you learn that they developed this entire subdivision in the cemetery and never moved any of the bodies. And so they're all kind of rising up out of the dead, and you know, it was a Steven Spielberg movie. It's actually a pretty good movie. It was like when he did that in E.T. they were real big back then. But I'm like, somebody didn't follow this provision in that movie either. So those are the three things that come up to me. One project that I worked for the client, the other was a TV show, and the other was a movie. So if you haven't seen it, now that you know this provision, you can think about it next time. Okay, allocations, and then allowances. So we'll finish up Article 3.8, and then we'll take a break. Actually, let's do 3.9, because our allowance is really quick. Allowances will not be in the exam. I just wanted to tell you what they are. Allowances are when, and there's this thing, it talks about the cover cost for the contractor and their ordinary allowances. Think of it this way. I'm designing a house. I'm the architect. I'm designing a house. I come to my owner, and I'm like, okay, we got to put your kitchen appliances in. Do we want GE, or do you want to go like upscale to like Sub-Zero or Wolf or somebody's really high-end? And the owner's like, I'm waiting on my Christmas bonus, you know, like Clark Griswold in Christmas Vacation. I don't know if I'm going to get the bonus or not. So do we have to make that decision now? No, we don't. What we're going to do is we're going to design where those appliances are going to go, and we're going to say appliances needed to be filled in later. But I need what you think you can spend right now. Can you give me a ballpark of how much for the appliances? Okay, I can make sure I can guarantee $10,000. So when the project goes out to bid, what you tell the contractor is, put an allowance for appliances for $10,000. That way we don't know what they're going to be. And if it comes in, we buy the GE and it's only spend $8,000, the price of the project goes down by $2,000. But if we buy the Wolf and it's $15,000, the project goes up by $5,000. An allowance is just a placeholder when you don't know exactly what's going to go in there. The easiest example is kitchen appliances, but it could be a lot of things allowances could be. I'm still making a decision on light fixtures for the entire building or stuff like that. So it's a money spot. It's a holding place. Something's going to go in there, but we're not sure what it is. I'm not going to get into questions of the exam for it, but allowances happen all the time in your profession, so that's why I want to explain what it is. And we'll do 3.9 and then we'll take a break. Superintendent. So that's the guy or the woman that works for the contractor that's running the show on the project site. And so the superintendent shall represent the contractor. So right here, this is stating the superintendent has agency. They're going to be able to speak, and what they say is binding on the contractor. And communications given to the superintendent shall be binding as if given to the contractor. So when the owner talks to the super, and the project manager says, I didn't know that, because the project manager sits above everything, You don't care because you gave the information and notice to the superintendent. It's binding. That's your agency question. The contractor sues practical after the award. This is a 392. So after the award, you got to notify the owner and the architect in the name of the qualifications of that super. Sally's going to be my super. Here's what she's done on the other projects before. That's that project key personnel, the team you're putting together. And then the architect and the owner can object to that, but where it specifically says this failure of the architect, the architect's probably going to know more about what a superintendent should have than your average owner, because they have more knowledge than architect of the construction industry. Failure of the architect to provide notice within 14 days shall constitute notice of no reasonable objection. So if I, architect, don't say anything, the super is fine. The contractor can't come back later and say, we don't like your super because they don't have qualifications. You had your opportunity under this. So this puts an obligation. The architect in this case will be doing that. It's not speaking on behalf of the owner, but it's the same. This one is where it doesn't say the architect has the authority, but this is where the architect would be speaking, and it would apply both to the owner and the architect. And then the contractor under 393 shall not change the superintendent without the owner's consent, which shall not be unreasonably withheld or delayed. So you can't just say, I'm taking Sally and putting her on my next job. Why? Well, because that job is more important to me, and I'm going to put my better superintendent on it. Nope, we have Sally for the whole project. But if you say, I'm going to be taking Bob off the project because they're moving, well, that's a reason you can't reasonably object. You can't make Bob stay here. Or maybe Bob got a promotion, and it's not in his job description anymore, or what have you. If they can give some reasons, then the owner shall not unreasonably object to it. You can't force them to always be there. But you want to try to keep, as the owner, and as the architect protecting the owner, you want to try to keep the A-team in there. That's it for right now. You guys take a 5-minute break, or 10-minute break, whatever you need, and then you can come back, and then we'll get through definitely the rest of 3 and 4. All right? Pause. Okay. We're going to go back in. 310. Contractors construction submittals schedules. And submittal construction and submittal schedules. So this is the scheduling for the project of when you're going to have things go. The contractor, promptly after being awarded the contract, shall submit to the owner and architect information of a contractor's construction schedule for the work. This is where I'm going to dig the hole. This is when I'm going to put in the foundation. This is when I'm going to put up the structure of either steel or rough carpentry. It's a schedule of how things go. It's going to be on a long chart. It's called a Gantt chart. It's a bar chart that goes across. You create a path of how, from the beginning to the end. And it's so you can schedule things out. It's for everybody to understand what trades are going to be there when. And it's the lifeblood. It is the lifeline of a project. The most important, in my opinion, even more important than the drawings, the most important thing in a construction project is the schedule. Because the schedule is built on top of the drawings, so the drawings, what needs to be built, creates what the schedule is going to be and how long time it's going to take to build that, and time is money. And if you can't keep to that schedule, the project can be more expensive no matter what, and people don't fight about things that are free. They fight about money. So if things get off schedule, you're going to have a fight. So it is the lifeline. It is the blood of what things go through. So the contractor has to provide a construction schedule within a reasonable period of time. A lot of times the negotiations are such that before you sign this contract, the schedule's done. But it certainly has to be given pretty quickly because the owner doesn't want to be like, how long is this going to take? How long is this going to take? So that's the first part. And it shall include the date of commencement of the work, any important milestones that happen in the middle, the date of substantial completion, which we talked about before, it's when the project can be used for its intended purposes, and a portion of the work of the construction activity, meaning what's going to happen when, and then the time required for each completion for each portion, each of those portions. So we know that at this point in time, all the foundations should be done, or the rough carpentry should be finished. And the reason why you need that start date and end date of each portion is because there are these professionals out there that are schedulers. And they, for a long-term project, so a lot of the projects I work on are going to be 18 months to 36 months, so they take quite some time. And I have scheduling people that can see something that happens on date X, and they can predict that 6 months later, this is going to be what the problem is because of the schedule. Because they're so in tune to how the schedule is and how the work is and compiling. Sometimes it even is as little as, I see your schedule, and I'm looking how much you're billing the project, and you're not spending enough money. This is a $20 million project. We're halfway through, and you've only billed me for $5 million. That means in the second half, we're going to compress $15 million of work. It's not going to work because you're going to have too many trades on top of each other, too many people waiting. So time is money. The schedule affects that. And so you need the contractor to give this information so the owner, the architect, and if you have a scheduler, can make sure we're all moving forward. The worst thing that can happen on a project, in my opinion, having done this for 30-some years, is that the owner has a complex project and doesn't have a sophisticated scheduler on their side, because the owner will be the last person to know that the project is late and delayed. The contractor, because if they're not following the cash flow of money, they're not looking at the schedule, they don't understand what's going on, the contractor will always be like, I can make it up, I can do this, I can do that. But when it finally turns out that the owner gets the light bulb that we're not going to meet the delay, it's too late. So I always advise my clients that are building anything of any substantial size, bring in someone that can look over the contractor's shoulder and make sure that schedule is being reviewed. None of that's in this agreement. This is just a requirement of what needs to be in the schedule. I have a document that I attach that amplifies this even more. I want more information on this because it's so important. But this is what's required under the contractor for the construction schedule under 310.1. 310.2 says promptly after being awarded, and therefore necessary to maintain a curtain submittal schedule, and they need to submit the schedule for the architect's approval. A submittal schedule is, the architect has asked us to put in these type of light fixtures, or these use these bricks, or use this type of wood, or the paint colors, whatever those might be. They may be this type of truss system. So, but it's not fully designed, or we haven't picked the brick yet, or we're not sure. So the specifications have information that's being asked for the contractor to supply. The contractor must submit those cut sheets of here's five bricks that we think fit what you're going to be putting up. Pick which one's right. I approve brick number three. Or here's what we think the lighting fixtures are going to use, and it's a piece of paper that describes it. It's got the foot candles, and it's got the lumens, or whatever it might be, all that information. The architect says, yes, this is the type, so that's a submittal. One of the other submittals, which we're going to talk about in a second here, is called shop drawings. Shop drawings are, if the architect, and I've mentioned this a few times in class, if the architect designs, for example, the HVAC system with this ductwork, the architect for this project may have said, I want to have cylindrical tubular ductwork as opposed to box ductwork. Because they, as a design aesthetic in this room, thought it would look cool to have these cylindrical. This could have been specified by the architect, but it probably wasn't specified as how big these pieces of ductwork were, the circumference of them. But the architect says, is I need to have this ductwork in this room to make sure that there's enough airflow in here. And then the HVAC subcontractor goes and does the math and figures out how to move enough cubic airflow through here and then picks the diameter of the ductwork. Now, we see it visibly in here. Obviously, in most spaces, it's behind the drywall. And so it may be how things are fit in. But the architect will approve, and this will come back in a shop drawing. You'll be able to see, I'm using ductwork of this size. Now, in this case, because it's possible that the architect in this room wanted the ductwork to be visible and had an idea, they may have said, I don't like the way your vents are. You need to have a different vent system with the way these are cut in. You know, maybe, because some vents are curved, they're more expensive, but they could do that. There may be some changes the architect doesn't approve, but the shop drawing would show that. And the shop drawing's for all different types of things. Like if I'm going to be establishing a column, and the column is going to be bolted to a concrete pad, the architect designed the footing for the pad, And the architect said the column needs to be a certain height and it's going to be carrying these loads. But the contractor then designs the actual column and the bolt locations of where the bolts are going to be bolting it into the concrete. That's going to come up in a shop drawing. Those are submittals. And back to 310.2, the contractor creates a submittal schedule because you can't put up a brick wall until you pick the bricks. So it has to happen enough time for, here's a bunch of bricks, and when the architect approves, they give the approval to the contractor orders the bricks are delivered on site, now we can build the wall. So there's all the stuff that happens in this schedule before the brick, the wall gets built. The main construction schedule has a spot that says brick wall being built. But the submittal schedule says all the stuff that happens to lead up to get to that. So there's two different schedules of how they work. And those schedules will also include how much time the owner can respond, which it'll talk about here. Should be coordinated with the contractor's construction schedule. Allow the architect reasonable time to review those. So I get to review to see the stuff works if I want. And if the contractor fails to submit the construction schedule or the submittal schedule, or fails to write submittals in accordance with the submittal schedule, the contractor should not be entitled for any increase in contract sum or extension of time. If I don't give you the time of when I'm going to be giving you this, and now I have to get more workers on the project site because I didn't know when my bricks were going to arrive, and now I got to double up my workers because I'm behind on that. If I didn't give you the submittal schedule, if I didn't follow that submittal schedule, that's my problem. And so any delays and additional costs that I have to carry, the contractor has to pay, not the owner. So that's, again, two provisions that's very important of how you keep on track with schedule. 311, documents and samples in the sites. Change orders, construction change directives, and other modifications in good order shall be marked and currently indicate the field changes and selections made during construction and the approved shop drawings, which are defined here, product data defined in samples and other similar required submittals, either electronic form or paper. So what these are saying is if you have a change order, it's got to be documented. It's got to be in writing, and we have to have those, and that shows what's happened in the project. Shop drawings, submittals, product data, those aren't contract documents because they weren't in that definition in the beginning, but they are defined terms. They all should be documented so we know what's going on in the course of the project. Shop drawings, product data, and samples. So we'll talk about exactly what they are. Shop drawings are drawings, diagrams, schedules, and other data specifically prepared for the work by the contractor or the subcontractor. It's not by the architect. Architects don't prepare shop drawings. The entity that's installing that work prepares shop drawings. And it illustrates some portion of the work. So how that means and methods, that's what the shop drawings show. I'm going to show you this column that's going to sit in this spot. I, as the person that's manufacturing that column, am going to create a shop drawing to show the means and methods for attaching it to this concrete pad. Architect doesn't design that, but the shop drawing from the steel guy will say this many bolts in these locations torqued to this level. There's actually a torque wrench that they have. You set it, and you go until it won't move anymore because it's set at this torque level. Or welds. You have to have this type of weld. All these types of things is going to show up in the shop drawings. And you may remember when I talked about the B101, when the architect looks at the shop drawings, they don't have to check the math. So they don't have to check the calculations of that bolt pad and the locations and the torque, because those were created and designed by the steel manufacturer, the steel subcontractor, for the same reason why the contractor doesn't have to check and do the math of the architect's drawings. So while the drawing's important for the construction of the facility, architect reviews them and makes sure they're within the design intent, but they don't check the math, but they are necessary for the construction of the project. Product data, illustrations, schedules, otherwise, of, you know, like here's a picture of what the light fixture is going to be, or here's a picture of the plumbing fixture, whatever. And then samples, physical pieces like the bricks, or maybe you bring in a couple light fixtures or whatever. So those are pretty simple. The shop drawings, like I said, are a little bit, because they're drawings, people are like, well, I still don't understand why the architect doesn't do it. one of the biggest reasons why is the architect doesn't need to be a specialist in each and every single trade. Like, that's why you have an electrical contract subcontractor, because they are specialists in their electrical part. So how they put the junction or the fuse box together, that's going to be all designed by the architect, or by the electrical subcontractor. You know, just like the ductwork and the size of the ductwork is going to be designed by the HVAC subcontractor, not the architect. Questions on that? Anything? Okay. Oh, I think this is a repeat. No. Trumpering predicated samples, submittals are not contract documents. Specifically says not contract documents. And the purpose is to demonstrate how the contract proposes to conform the information given to them, the drawings and specifications, the design contracts expressed, and how they're going to make that manifest into this room. So maybe the architect drew in this room having these round ducts. Or maybe they just said, I want exposed ductwork and didn't pick round or square or even locations. So the subcontractor for the HVAC subcontractor is going to do the shop drawings to show what it will be, and this is my interpretation of the design intent. And the architect, it says, shall, subject to limitations of 427, which we'll get there, to look at the submittals, the architect is not expected to take responsive actions may be so identified in the contract documents. Submittals that are not required by the contract documents may be returned by the architect without action. They can just say, here, go back. And that without action could be approval or disapproval, they just can return them back. To say, I don't need them, one way or the other. Or, I'm not going to approve them. You just go ahead and build that. So sometimes they're going to approve them. Sometimes they can just return them and say, I'm not doing anything. I'm not changing them. Sometimes they can go back with action and say, these are not sufficient. So there's not an obligation for the architect to approve every single shop drawing because they're not contract documents. They aren't ultimately going to be what will be important if the wall falls down. Because could be the shop drawings were right or not, but that's still the subcontractor's responsibility. Now, what's really interesting as a side note, you will have litigation where the shop drawings are going to be reviewed, and maybe it turns out that the shop drawings were incorrect. They weren't proper. And sometimes even it goes so far to say the architect should have seen this in the shop drawings, and the architect will go back to his contract and says, I'm not responsible for checking the math. And they can, depending on how maybe completely blatant and obvious, can get out of the obligation because that's the obligation of the subcontractor. So, because ultimately what the contractor is responsible for is building the building as it's intended. And so, if the wall falls down or not, it may not be because of the shop drawing. It doesn't matter if it's shop drawing. The contract says the wall has to stay up. That's all that's sufficient for the contract documents. And if it falls down and the design was sufficient to the standard of care, that it's a construction defect, shop drawings are not. So, but you always have shop drawings because it helps to make sure it's going to be done right. 3.12.5. The contractor shall review for compliance with the contract documents, approve and submit to the architect shop drawings, predicated samples, and other submittals required for the contract documents. This says, I'm getting all this information from my specialty subs, my HVAC, my electrical, my plumbing, my, you know, all these people are giving this information. And it says, I, as the contractor, still must review and approve them and send them for review by the architect. So this puts that responsibility where it says, hey, I'm the owner and the plumbing doesn't work, I only have to sue the contractor because of 3.12.5 says I, contractor, reviewed and approved them and then sent them over to architect to make sure they're within conformance of the intent of the contract documents. Question.
So if the contractor sees something wrong, then they can go back to the
architect? They do. And what can happen, and I had a case that was a long case, and one of the key elements here was the contractor made this comment that said, we are a paper contractor, and that means we don't do any of the work. We hire all the trades. And then the next part of the argument was, because we hire all the trades and we're just a paper contractor, we don't need to have the specialty knowledge to make sure that each and every shop drawing is proper. That's why we hire the subcontractors. They made that argument, and the opinion ultimately was not as clear on this issue, but it was the key issue in the case. They prevailed, but this provision was not in the contract. So they could make that argument because nowhere in the contract that they used had an obligation for the contractor to review. So what they said was, we got the shop drawings, we sent them to the architect. They said they were fine, and they built it, we built it, and they didn't say anything was wrong with it, so we're okay. We're a paper contractor. Now, I represented the owner, and I argued vigorously that that's not proper, that they still have this obligation. We know the shop drawings are in a contract document. And for whatever reason, the panel wanted to go in favor of the contractor, but they never really addressed the specific issue. They did a lot of pointing, finger pointing at the architect, so the architect should have caught it and everything else. But what's really supposed to happen, as this agreement is, just like you said, contractor looks at it. If he or she doesn't believe it's in conformance with the drawings, they send it back to the subcontractor. If they think they do, they send it to the architect. The architect can send it back and say, I don't think this conforms to my design intent, even if I haven't done the math, and then they have to be redrawn. So there's a number of opportunities for them to be corrected and brought back. So, and then it talks about they have to do this with a reasonable promptness. Often you'll see in this provision 7 to 10 days, depending on it, or the schedule, that's the middle schedule that's created, has these different timelines of when. So you, if you don't use reasonable profits, it may be just in this middle schedule of what your turnaround time is. And by submitting these shop drawings, and this other provision was not in this contract that we had, the contractor represents to the owner and the architect the contractor has, one, have reviewed and approved them, two, determined and verified field materials, field measurements, and field construction criteria, and three, checked and coordinated his information contained within such submittals. So this steps up what the contractor is responsible for. And the very purpose for these two provisions, I didn't draft the contract in that case, is to get around or avoid, not get around, to avoid the situation where the contractor would be like, I didn't know because I rely on my subs and the architect didn't do their job, which isn't the standard in the industry, but it also wasn't a contract obligation in the agreement that we litigated, so it became a problem. 2.7, the contractor should perform no portion of the work for which the contract documents require submittals and review of shop drawings, blah, 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 until the respective submittal has been approved by the architect. Now, the architect can return it with no comments and can say it's approved, but normally what you want is to go back and say approved. And the approval, though, is not I have done the math. It says it's consistent with the intent, the design intent, of when the project is going to be completed. But they're not supposed to continue. If the shop drawings have been given, they're supposed to take a look at it, make sure that they've been reviewed and approved, and sent back before they can do the work. 312.8, the contractor shall not be relieved of responsibility for deviations from the requirements in the contract documents by the architect's approval. So they can't say, hey, they approved and we built it and it's their fault, not mine. But if it deviates from the intent, they can't rely when we're talking about shop drawings, product data, and samples. They still, the contractor is ultimately responsible for means, methods, techniques, sequences, and procedures, and the warranty that the materials are good quality and new. So, unless, it's always a saving grace, or not always, but often a saving grace, unless the contractor has specifically notified the architect in writing of such a deviation for the submittal, hey, we got this approved submittal back, we put up this ductwork, it's round instead of square, we're going to tell you about it, we gave you some notice about that, which would be in writing, and the architect has given a written approval back, oh yeah, that's cool, actually I like the round better than the square, or the rectangular, or a change order construction change directive has been issued authorizing the deviation. So if you decide to go off the board by the contractor, you got to put it down on paper and you got to get it approved somehow. You can't just do this on your own. You're not the designer. Now you may do that because it's the only way it can fit. Like think about ductwork and you're going to have behind a soffit. That just happened in my first condo that I bought. There was new construction, and they had to ring ductwork to go through the way the building was built. And it was at the end of a row of townhomes, So my wall was different than all the other internal walls, and they lost space because it was a thicker wall with the brick and everything else. So they had to run the ductwork differently in the bedrooms. So I lost a bunch of ceiling height in my closet. And they called me in and they asked me about it, and we actually did some redesign. But I lost some because the way the drawings were, it wasn't going to work. So they had to deviate from the drawings. It was not material, it was location. And that was a coordination issue, but we ended up, and I approved as the owner. I said, okay, that's cool. We can do that. I'll lose some space up in my closet, but if not, at least some ductwork jutting out into my bedroom. So that can happen, and that's what happens here. You gave notice. You told what was going to go on. You got approval. I wrote a change order, and we were good. We moved on. So, 312, in the absence of such notice, when you're giving notices about going on, the architect's approval of a resubmission shall not apply to such revisions. So this talks about if you're writing a resubmitted shop drawing, and if there's not proper notice on it, the approval of such a resubmission shall not apply to those revisions. If you don't document that this is a resubmittal, then we don't have the documentation of, even though it's not as clear, what's the architect really approving? Are they approving the resubmittal? Are they approving the first one? What's going on? So you just, this is another word of the wise of 312.9, of make sure you're documenting what's going on with your submittals and shop drawings, product data, or otherwise. 312.10, the contractor shall not be required to provide professional services, design services, that constitute the practice of architecture or engineering services, unless such services are specifically required by the contract documents. Now, I'll finish reading this and I'll talk about it. Or unless the contractors need to provide such services in order to carry out the contractor's responsibilities for the construction, needs, methods, techniques, etc., etc. So what this provision means is you do not have to be an architect or engineer contractor. You build what's on the drawings and specifications in front of you. That's your job. Unless, in those drawings and specifications it says, this needs to be designed by the contractor. And then the contractor either designs it themselves or they hire someone to design it. Now, why would that happen? Well, there are certain things that are consistent in the industry that the architect does not design. One is called shoring and bracing. So you're digging that hole, and the ground is going to be moving on you. The contractor, the architect says, this is where you dig the hole. The contractor, or the owner, gives the contractor the soil sample so they can see how structural integrity in that soil. But ultimately, when that hole is dug, if you have a building next door, the weight coming down to that building will push out where that hole is, and so you have to brace that wall area. That shoring and bracing, by custom and standard in the industry, is designed by the contractor's foundation guy. And I've had projects where the building next door just, where the shoring and bracing wasn't sufficient, and the building next door started pushing, and so not only were they losing the integrity of the wall there, but the building next door started having cracking in their foundation because they lost the structural integrity. So it can be extremely expensive. Shoring and bracing is almost always contractor that they have to do the design. Fire protection system. These red lines in here is your fire protection system. That's because each fire protection company, the way their systems work, are proprietary. The intellectual property and how the system works is owned and designed by that company, and there's all about fire codes and regulations, and so fire protection is always going to be designed by the fire protection installer. Curtain windows, curtain walls that you're going to do. The system of how the clips and how the windows and everything is going to be connected, the sealants and everything else, that's another thing that's almost always going to be designed by the manufacturer of the curtain wall. So this is what's called delegated design. So what this provision says is, I never have to be a designer unless the drawings have something in that would be delegated design. Those are three. Sometimes there's other ones that the contractor or the architect will delegate. And then in those instances, the contractor has to go out and hire someone to do those designs on the engineering side. Okay? By and large, it doesn't happen in a lot of projects because you don't have these specialty things. Or if you dig a hole, you're not close enough to another building that you need shoring or bracing. That can happen. I did a house on Lake Michigan, $22 million house on Lake Michigan, and they put, it was all the way down to the water, obviously. It was, I think, 250 so the length of the property. And so the house was in the top of the hill first kind of flat, and then it went down a little bit, and then they put in a pool, and then way down by the boat, by the water, they built a big boathouse, a couple $1 million for the boathouse. So they put this pool in, and the house nearly to the north was actually, the slope of the land was going up. So we had to put in this massive shoring and bracing, because that owner didn't want, there was no building right next to where the pool was going to be, but they didn't want their land sliding into our property. So there was this, they dug these huge piles that went in, and it was this massive steel shoring and bracing that they put in and put the pool in, and everything was great. The boathouse, we also had new shoring and bracing, but a year later the lake took it. Just half of the boathouse just went down because of the water. You know, you can't do anything about Mother Nature, but it just went out to the sea. Because even though they did shoring and bracing and everything else, there was nothing you could do about that. But it was an interesting, you know, we had to have a contract with the next door neighbor that related to the work that was going on with the pool. And it was like noise volume because we had to pound the piles in, had to be, their engineer had to approve things, a lot of other stuff, and that all went fine. But there was a lot of concern with that construction because of the way the land was configured. And all the design was done by the contractor and their subcontractors, not by my architect. So, 3.12.10.1. The owner and the architect will specify all performance and design criteria that such services may satisfy. So if you are going to delegate design, the architect has to tell you what's being delegated. The contractor doesn't have to guess. It's going to say you must design this in some term or otherwise. And then if there's going to be stuff and information that's being here, so like the pool and how the design of the pool is going to be, the contractor should be entitled to rely upon the adequacy and accuracy of the performance and design criteria. We gave to them the size of the pool and what was going to happen and how it was supposed to be designed and what the buildings were going to be in this area, and that all translated into different weights and masses as far as down forces and lateral forces and everything else. And the contractor was allowed to rely on that information when they're designing their shoring and bracing. And then also the information we got from the neighbor, they had to rely on that information as far as what could come down from upstream. You know, from not stream really, but uphill, I guess that's what you say. So this basically says here, when they can rely on it, it says if you give me information that I'm not responsible for, I get to say that it's accurate. I can rely on it. 3.12.10 continue. The owner and the architect shall be entitled to rely upon the accuracy, adequacy, and accuracy of the services and approvals provided by the contractor and their design professionals. So if you're hiring me, a curtain wall manufacturer and installer, and I'm going to have some other architectural elements that are going to be part of the way that wall looks, so it's not going to be only curtain wall, I get to rely on what their designers do. You know, contractor can rely on the architect, but if there's something that goes on the contractor side, the architect and the owner can rely on those design professionals. It's just a two-way street that works for that. And then if the contract documents in 3.12.10.2, if the contract documents require the contractor's design professional to certify that the work has been performed in accordance with the design criteria, the contractor should provide that certification. If you remember, in the B101, the architect is certifying the work is being done properly. They say, hey, I've looked at it. It's done great. I'm going to sign off on this so you can pay the contractor. I approve of this. For a work that's performed by their design professional, the architect doesn't approve it. The owner doesn't approve it. They have to approve it, the contractor. They have to own it and say, I'm certifying that it was done properly. So the responsibilities are carried there. 3.17, royalties, patents, and copyrights. The contractor shall pay for all royalties and license fees. They shall defend suits. What happened? I thought it was plugged in. Can we have more technological defects today? I'm plugged in. See if it comes back up. Thank you. 317. Remember in the B101 we talked about the copyright and the ownerships of the instruments of service, the drawings prepared by the architect and their consultants. This is different, even though it's talking about royalties, patents, and copyrights. This is if the contractor, let's say the contractor's installing a pump system, that the operation of it is patented. And the only way that the owner can use this pump system that's patented is if someone paid the designer the royalties and secured the license. This says the contractor has to secure that. They're going to pass that cost on to the owner. But if you think about it, in the B101, on Article 7, the architect is getting a license to the owner to use the drawing, so the owner is securing that license. On this thing, if the contractor has to use something that is licensed, that needs licensing, or there's royalties or patents or whatever, and it does happen with lots of sophisticated systems, like in all these power plants that I've built, all the design of how all these systems work, you have to pay the entity that designed it. There has to be royalties and licenses, not only to use it in the beginning and to build it, but then the owner continues to pay on a year-by-year basis. So what this says is, as you're building it, or maybe the contractor is using a piece of equipment for construction that's only for construction, they have to have the license. It doesn't stay as part of the building, but they have a license to do that. This is an obligation for the contractor to use that equipment. I'll give you one quick example. I represented a company, and I think I may have talked about this in the past. They started their business in the oil rigging industry. And when you drill the well and the well comes up, you got to figure out how to cap it, how to change your pipes, and how the oil is distributed. And you want to keep the oil flowing all the time. So they developed a system prior to what's called hot tapping, that they would design it so the oil kept flowing. They would build a line that goes right next to it, and within a matter of hours, they would be able to tap and keep going, and they would, maybe an hour or two of things that they would lose as far as the flow of oil. So the time, and they designed the patent for this hot tapping equipment. They eventually expanded it to huge pipes, and so we did a project here in Chicago, and I did one in New York, where we were bringing all the water from the water things out in Lake Michigan and brought it into seven suburbs here for a 96-inch pipe, so that's an 8-foot pipe, and hot tapping of that. There were royalties and patents that the contractor doing the overall project had to secure from my client to be able to use that hot tapping equipment, and then we took the equipment away. So it wasn't a permanent part of the project, but the equipment used had a license and royalty fees. That's what this provision is about. It's not about the drawings from the architect. It's about what the contractor may have to use for their work or to be installed into the building. So that's 217. 318, you will not be tested on this, but I want to show it to you what it is. We've talked about indemnity. So what indemnification here is that this says the contractor shall indemnify and hold harmless the owner, the architect consultants, agents, blah, 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 against claims, damages, losses, and expenses, blah, 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 arising out or resulting from the performance of the work. Those are related to bodily injury, sickness, death, disease or death, destruction of tangible property, blah, 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 but only to the extent caused by the negligent or acts or omissions of the contractor, subcontractor, yada, 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 for whom anyone may, their acts may be at fault. So, what does this mean? This means that if, in the course of the work, someone is injured, or there's property damage, tangible property damage, maybe like a car falls, wall falls on a car, or something else, and there's some exceptions to that we won't get into, it's called the economic loss rule, blah, blah, blah. This says, if the owner gets sued by the injured party, or the person that lost their, got damaged their property, and the owner gets sued, but the contractor doesn't, maybe the wall falls down 6 months, a year, 3 years after the work is performed, and the person that's injured doesn't know who the contractor is, but they certainly know who the owner is. They sue the owner and says, you crushed my leg. This wall fell on me and crushed my leg. I'm suing you for my personal injury because the wall fell down. This says I get to go back to the contractor and say, you must indemnify, you must pick up and pay for that cost of this person's crushed leg. That's what indemnity is, for your failure to perform the work. And it says, though, only to the extent caused by the negligent act or omissions of the contractor. So if the wall fell down because it was the architect's fault, then you look to the indemnity in the architecture agreement. If the wall falls down because it was the contractor's fault, you look to the indemnity. But if a third-party claim where you look to the party, so third party against me, not an owner, not the contractor, the owner, contractor and owner and the contractor together, their first-party claims, it's a third party sitting out there, they sue the owner, third-party claim, I say it's not my problem, it's the contractor's problem, you indemnify me. That's what this provision is talking about. Again, I've talked about it enough in class, and like I said, there's a lot of lawyers that don't even really, they even get confused, like, oh, it could be first-party indemnity and lots of stuff that you can get into, but the purpose of this, I just want you to tell you that there is an indemnity provision because it's so important, and you want to make sure, like I said in the architecture side, every agreement you have should have this indemnity provision in it. And then 382 talks a little bit about, and then I ran out of battery again, so maybe I need a new laptop, talks about what the claims are and everything else. So you won't need to know what it is for the test. I just want you to understand it because it's out there for all of your practice. Of when you can point to the finger of the right person that did it. So, with that, have a nice weekend. I will edit next week's lecture because I'm supposed to do 5, and I'm going to get here at least a half hour early.